Hello there. Today's Tuesday, July the 4th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, North Korea launches another ballistic missile.
Sooner or later, it will get out of control, and the consequences would be disastrous.
President Trump continues his Twitter war against the media. Germany's new law taking aim at hate speech on social media. Also ahead, the latest superhero movie comes to U.S. movie theaters. It's all on today's International Edition. North Korea has launched yet another ballistic missile in the direction of Japan, according to South Korean officials. It comes as concerns grow over the North working to build a nuclear-tipped missile that could reach the United States. Just last week, South Korean President Moon Jae-in and U.S. President Donald Trump focused much of their first meeting on opposing North Korea's development of atomic weapons that threaten both allies. It also comes as China's U.N. ambassador warned on Monday that further escalation of already high tensions with North Korea risks getting out of control.
Three things are essential: denuclearization, peace and security, peace and stability, and also negotiations and dialogue to seek solutions. Currently, tension is high, and we certainly would like to see de-escalation of tension, because if tension only goes up and goes up only, then sooner or later it will get out of control and the consequences would be disastrous.
Liu Jun expressed hope that key nations' support for China's three-part plan to de-escalate tensions and revive negotiations and dialogue leading to denuclearization and peace and stability on the Korean Peninsula. An initial proposal is suspension for suspension, which would see North Korea giving up its nuclear and missile testing and the U.S. and South Korea stopping military exercises. VOA's Victor Beatty talks to Troy Stangerone with the Korea Economic Institute, asking if this is even a feasible option to finding resolution.
I think this is a difficult proposal to go forward. It's something we've seen the Chinese pushing for a while. It's something that we also briefly saw a slightly less version of, but a trial balloon from an advisor to President Moon Jae-in of South Korea, and it hasn't gone anywhere. And one of the primary reasons for this is that right now we have a situation to where North Korea is conducting nuclear tests and missile tests and is doing so in violation of UN resolutions. At the same time, the United States and South Korea have every right to conduct exercises in self-defense. And I think if we look in the past, we had a situation where exercises have been suspended before and scaled back, and it hasn't led to the results that people are looking for. So in the absence of real efforts on the North Korean side and the Chinese side for denuclearization, I think it's difficult to ask the United States and South Korea to scale back their exercises.
Well, as you know, Presidents Trump and Xi spoke by phone Sunday night about the growing threat from North Korea's nuclear and missile programs. Last week, the U.S. blacklisted a Chinese bank over its business ties with Pyongyang. Is China feeling the heat?
Not yet, but I think they will in time. This is most likely the first signal from the administration that they will go after Chinese banks. This is something to where, to a large extent, in the hopes of gaining cooperation from China, the U.S. has refrained from sanctioning Chinese financial entities. The difficulty has become, as President Trump himself pointed out, while the U.S. has been patient with China to try and gain its cooperation, China either has not provided enough cooperation or the efforts it has made have not been successful. And in light of that, the U.S. is going to have to begin taking unilateral steps in enforcing laws that are already on the books. And so if this is the case to where Beijing can do more and has been withholding it, now is the time for Beijing to do that.
China's ambassador at the UN said that while not referring to any country directly, expressed the hope the other parties will, quote, be more forthcoming in accepting China's package. What might he mean?
This is difficult to say because, you know, President Trump and the Obama administration before it have all been open to negotiating with North Korea. The only essentially real prerequisite that the United States has put on the table has been that the talks have to be about denuclearization, and they have to be legitimate talks about denuclearization. They can't simply be on the pretext of that and then something else. And so I think there's actually a very basic proposal the U.S. has had on the table much longer that would take and de-escalate things, which is that we get into serious discussions of how we denuclearize the Korean Peninsula, which, it should be pointed out, North Korea had already agreed to in bilateral talks with South Korea many years ago and has violated as well. And so I think this is the real key. It's not a question of other parties being more forthcoming. It's a question of the North Koreans being willing to come to the table and have discussions.
Troy, you're just back from South Korea. What's the sense there about the North?
I think it's a situation to where there is most likely frustration. The Moon Jae-in administration has made attempts to reach out to the North. They've tried to engage in sports diplomacy. They've tried to provide humanitarian aid, and the North Koreans have rejected those efforts. This is a situation to where I think you have an administration that genuinely wants to improve the situation between the two countries, but that's difficult if the North is not willing. And, you know, if we go back to the beginning of the Park Geun-hye administration, President Park also tried to reach out. The North Korea rejected that. You know, this is the difficulty in the situation. If you want to resolve the situation, if you want to engage the North, they have to be willing. And at least under Kim Jong-un, in contrast to his father, who would at times actually engage in talks and engage in some type of engagements, Kim Jong-un seems to be unwilling to do so.
What positive role could China play in your view?
I think at this point, the most positive role that China could play is that they need to explain to the North Koreans that, as President Trump has said, the U.S. patience is wearing thin. And whether that means that they will face increased sanctions for their activities related to North Korea, or whether it means that the U.S. might take other actions, the North Koreans need to understand that now is not the time to think that they can take and continue to delay. And beyond that, China needs to take, and there are a series of financial firms that the United States has presented to China as firms that are taking and engaging in illicit activities with North Korea, and China needs to take serious action against those firms. And until they do, I think we're going to face difficulties.
That's Troy Stangaron with the Korea Economic Institute. Here are some of the stories we're following at voanews.com. President Trump will meet with Angela Merkel before the G20 summit this week. An appeals court rules against the EPA in a methane gas regulation. 10 people taken to hospitals after a taxi hits a crowd at a Boston airport. And the 4th of July brings mixed feelings for some minorities. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. President Donald Trump keeps adding fuel to his fiery Twitter battle against the media. The press is an easy target for the Republican president and one his supporters love to hate. Trump's latest bash was a repurposed old video he tweeted on the weekend of him fake pummeling a wrestling promoter whose face had been replaced by the CNN logo. It was unprecedented even for Trump, a sitting president, in effect promoting physical assault of a media stand-in. Media watchdogs quickly called him out. VOA's Steve Norman has more.
The video singling out CNN President Trump posted to his Twitter account came from a professional event where Mr. Trump performed outside the wrestling ring in a fake match. The CNN logo is superimposed on the head of Mr. Trump's conquered opponent. White House Homeland Security Advisor Tom Bossert rejected the idea that someone might interpret the Trump video as a threat against journalists. He appeared on the ABC television program this week.
He's the most genuine person, and the people that see politicians and then see him find him to be someone that they can understand and relate to.
Mr. Trump's tweet drew scores of negative reaction, but he issued another tweet pledging he would triumph over what he called the dishonest media. The tweet was accompanied with a video excerpt of his speech Saturday at a rally in Washington commemorating the upcoming Independence Day holiday.
The fake media is trying to silence us, but we will not let them, because the people know the truth. The fake media tried to stop us from going to the White House. But I'm president, and they're not.
President Trump has rallied against major newspapers and television networks for their coverage of his five-month-old presidency, but he has aimed increasing vitriol in recent days against CNN. I'm Steve Norman.
Well, joining me now for some perspective on the tensions between President Trump and the news media is Katie Culver, director of the Center for Journalism Ethics at the University of Wisconsin. So just how unusual is what is happening with the president's attacks on the press?
It's unprecedented in my time, and if I looked at my media historian colleagues, I think possibly at any time. There have been times of intense partisanship and intense scrutiny and politicians airing each other's dirty laundry in the press, but I just don't ever recall a time like this where we see, you know, personal attacks coming directly from the White House towards individual reporters, the sharing of alleged news that is nothing like news, you know, things like InfoWars being used as information sources. It's just an unprecedented time in my mind, and I also think it's a really dangerous time.
Explain why you think that it's dangerous for those people that may not really understand the ramifications of what's happening here and, of course, the First Amendment.
Look, American democracy is an experiment. It has been an incredibly successful experiment, but it is an experiment. The founders had an idea that if you have three branches of government serving as checks on each other, mm-hmm. Plus you have a free and independent press, and responsible press, I have to say, that serves as another check on that power. That's how democracy can survive. And I think when you have people in positions of power that are blatantly trying to damage trust in the news media and trying to hinder the practices of journalists, I think that poses real problems, real risks for a democracy, because we need journalists to be a check on power. I will say there are plenty of times that the news media get things wrong, and they need to be held accountable. In the same way that they try to hold Congress or the White House accountable, they need to be held accountable as well. But trying to put this cast pall, this stain over all news media practice, I think is very, very damaging.
This White House, as opposed to previous administrations that didn't, you know, they may have had rocky relationships with the press at times or not always liked the coverage they were getting, but it seems like this particular administration is, for lack of a better word, it seems vindictive if you don't say nice things about them. But what would be the point of a press just coming out and saying nice things? How would that separate the United States from a dictatorship where they have state-run media and they're forced to say nice things about their leaders?
Yeah, a democracy cannot exist with media that say only nice things about people in power. That's not how democracy works. It's just you have to have those outside of government able to hold government accountable, or you really do not have a free society. It's as simple as that. And, you know, I agree with you. There's no administration in my memory that has had a rosy relationship with the press. You know, the Obama administration and the White House Correspondents Association went at each other constantly. If you look back to coverage of the Obamacare debate, for instance, there were plenty in the White House who were furious at the way that debate was covered, and they wanted more positive coverage of their agenda. That's not what the news media are supposed to do. They're not supposed to take Obamacare and put it out on a platter and say this is the best thing since sliced bread and everybody's going to be insured and it's not going to cost anything. They're out there to serve as a check on the Obama administration. The same exact thing with the Trump administration, but I think you're right. There is a level to which this has become personal, and that may emanate mainly from the president. It also may be part of the people he has chosen for his administration. But it does feel more personal and more on the attack than I ever recall.
How concerned are you about the fact that not only do they seem to be keeping the press at bay, but they seem to be ramping up a dialogue that sort of taints the reputation of the media, calling them fake news, the enemy of the American people?
Yeah.
How concerned are you that people will buy that?
I think you have different pools of people. There are a group of Trump supporters, and I would say that that's a smaller group than Trump voters, people who voted for Trump. There are some people who voted who I wouldn't consider, you know, his ardent supporters. You know, they might have voted for him for another number of other reasons. But there is a core group of his supporters for which this kind of rhetoric resonates immensely. It's exactly what they wanted. They like Donald Trump because he is going to drain the swamp. And these national news media, that's part of the swamp. They are part of the elite. They are part of the insiders in Washington and New York. And I want no part of them. And when Donald Trump attacks them, I like it. That's in the mindset of some people. I'm not sure how you change that mindset. But we need not only news media to be defending themselves, but other people, business leaders, elected officials, coming out and saying, this is wrong. As much as I don't love some of the coverage that happens in the news media, we need a strong, vibrant, free, independent press.
All right. Katie Culver, director of the Center for Journalism Ethics at the University of Wisconsin. Thanks for being with us. You're listening to International Edition on VOA.
Hi, I'm Nikki Strong. You love music? How about Blake Shelton and Carrie Underwood? Or Merle Haggard and Loretta Lynn? Experience the best in country music on Country Hits USA. I bring you some country rock, outlaw, a little hillbilly, contemporary, and more, with a dash of entertainment news, too. So join me for Country Hits USA on VOA 1, the voice of America.
VOA News.
When news breaks, VOA News is there. Around the clock, listen to VOA Newscast at the top of each hour, along with our detailed news programs and analysis.
We are online at voanews.com.
VOA, your trusted source of news and information.
VOA's International Edition continues now. One of the themes of this year's Smithsonian Folklife Festival is immigration. As part of the festival events, a group of 29 children were sworn in as U.S. citizens just ahead of America's Independence Day holiday. VOA's Elizabeth Cherneff reports.
Washington's heat and humidity was no deterrent for a group of immigrant families watching as their children received their certificates of U.S. citizenship.
I'm really excited and I feel so happy.
12-year-old Sada from Colombia is one of 25 children honored at the ceremony. Her mother, Anna Maria, looked on proudly from the front row.
We are so happy for this opportunity. It was so special because it's a different place. Ceremony meant only for kids, and it's a special day for us.
Organizers say the 50th anniversary of the Smithsonian's annual Folklife Festival presented a unique opportunity to celebrate the next generation of Americans. Kim Zanotti, who administered the oath, says ceremonies like this one represent important chapters in each child's American story.
Now they have all the privileges that an American-born citizen, like myself, may take for granted. They can vote. They can totally participate in our democratic republic. They can hold political office. They can serve on a jury. They can get a United States passport, making it easy for them to travel back to their country or to any other country around the world. So it really is the start of their American journey.
A journey beginning just days before Independence Day, marking America's 241st birthday. Elizabeth Cherneff, VOA News, Washington.
Well, turning now to what's trending on social media, we are joined by Andrew Palchewski. Hey, Andrew, lots going on.
Lots indeed. Starting with Friday, the German parliament passing a law to require social networks to remove extreme or illegal content. Now, this was something that a number of countries had proposed, Germany included. France and the UK, we had talked about their leaders saying that they wanted to propose a law forcing social media to remove this content. Well, Germany has now passed this law, and it would require social networks to remove illegal content and hate speech and extremist content within 24 hours and block illegal accounts or hate speech accounts within a week. Now, there's some questions that this raises. What happens if the social networks don't comply? That's been answered as part of this bill. They could face fines up to 50 million euros, but it's not clear how that becomes implemented, how the fines are going to be doled out, if it's going to be 50 million right off the bat or if they're going to be lower levels. That's slightly unclear. Also unclear how much leeway social networks might have before they're penalized. If this is a one and done, if you violate the law, you get charged, you get fined, or if maybe there's a multiple steps if you fail over time that suddenly you're having to pay these larger and larger fines. Then there's also a question about the users. Could this mean additional monitoring of social media or restrictions on what people can post? And it goes back to this issue of where is the line between free speech and hate speech? Where does it fall between extremism and speaking openly online? And how do they define what extremist or hateful content is? So those questions are all being raised by this new social media law. I expect this is the first of but many laws that we're going to see, similar laws where social media is going to be held to account on the basis of these comments and the posts that go out, these extremist posts. But this marks the first instance, or at least one of the first instances, where the content hosters are being held accountable, not just the people posting the content.
Wow, very interesting. We're in a whole new territory here, for sure.
We are.
And anything else going on?
Well, for most of the world right now, and for us in just a short few minutes, it's going to be July 4th. Mm-hmm. And that means here in the United States, Independence Day. It's the 241st anniversary of the U.S. Declaration of Independence, when the U.S. decided to break away from the British Empire, kicking off the Revolutionary War. Spoiler alert, the U.S. won, and 241 years later, we're celebrating our freedom. So lots of barbecues, celebrations around the country, people on social media celebrating American history. I saw a hashtag of hashtag cookout do's and don'ts as people grill everything from hot dogs, hamburgers, vegetables, and enjoy themselves mm-hmm. across the country. And then, of course, on the evening of July 4th here in the U.S., fireworks will light up the sky across the country, including right here in the nation's capital of Washington, D.C., just a stone's throw, really, from where we are at our Voice of America yep. headquarters, just down the National Mall, right by the Washington Monument. We're going to have a big fireworks display
yep,
there.
Big celebration.
Big celebration. So lots of talk about that on social media. I saw someone post on social media. They said, everybody every year takes photos and videos of all these fireworks, but does anybody ever go back and actually look at them? It's kind of silly that people take these videos, but they just kind of sit there on people's phones. But we're going to see a lot of those videos on social media as those fireworks light up across the country.
Fun stuff. Thanks, Andrew.
Thank you.
All right. Well, you can follow him on Twitter at APAL. We also invite you to follow the International Edition stream at VOA_IE. Well, it is a holiday week here. Many Americans will be having barbecues and seeing fireworks, but others will want to take in a good movie. Joining me now to talk more about what's just opened in theaters is Vegas film critic Jeffrey K. Howard. Hey, Jeff, I hear we've got a new superhero film.
We're talking Spider-Man, one of the most iconic characters, I think, next to Batman and Superman. And, you know, Sony Pictures, Columbia has rebooted this thing three or four times. I think this is the sixth incarnation we have. We have a whole new kid playing Spider-Man. Tom Holland, you may remember the movie The Impossible, you know, when the tsunami flood in the Southeast Asia. Remember that movie where the family got separated? So he's, you know, playing Peter Parker. And this time around, Peter Parker is really played like a teenager. I mean, the previous movies we had, you know, it was kind of like, you know, really didn't dive into his everyday life as a teenager. But this time he actually is a teenager, you know, worrying about passing his Spanish test, going to homecoming, all the things that a 15-year-old kid would worry about. But then also, it's like we saw in Captain America Civil War, where we had a preview of Spider-Man, is that he is dying to be an Avenger. But he lacks the maturity, and he lacks everything, you know, that Tony Stark, you know, played by Robert Downey Jr., Iron Man, he's kind of taking him under his wing and saying, look, kid, you know, stop doing all this. I'm going to mentor you, but you just got to stay in school and lay low for right now because you're going to get in a lot of trouble. So he does in this movie. He puts people in danger. He does all kinds of crazy stuff. But meanwhile, we have another villain played by Michael Keaton. He plays the Vulture, which is a famous Spider-Man foe. But this is the first time we have a villain in a superhero movie, especially Spider-Man, where they're not kind of like crazy and trying to take over the world with these ridiculous Austin Powers kind of man of mystery plot devices. He's a working class man who had a salvage company that was taken over by Tony Stark, and he lost everything. So now he's turned to a life of crime. But he also has a very liberal message in it, because he tells Spider-Man, Peter Parker, look, we're from working class people. Tony Stark is this really rich guy. He, you know, we eat his table scraps, you know. We're just trying to survive down here. So there's a really unique message from Michael Keaton. He turns in an incredible performance as the Vulture. And it's just a really surprising movie. And, of course, there's great special effects. There's a great action sequence, you know, on top of the Washington Monument. There's also the Staten Island Ferry that Spider-Man has to keep from sinking. So not only is the story really cool, but also the special effects are out of this world. And what's really cool is that Sony gave complete control, creative control, to Marvel Pictures. So now we have crossovers from other Marvel characters that other studios own, meaning the Avengers, of course, is owned by Disney, and we get to see cameos from, like, Iron Man and Captain America and others. So it just really brings the Marvel Universe together, and this is a great summer film.
So this is definitely one you're giving a thumbs up for. People should definitely check it out.
It's Spider-Man. Yeah, I think it's a summer blockbuster, and everyone's going to go see it. And we're just lucky that it was entertaining, great story, great performances, great special effects. This is just a good time for all.
Awesome. And you've got another one, Baby Driver. What's that? That sounds like a child's story, but I have a feeling it's not.
It's not. It's a heist movie, and it's from director Edgar Wright. And you may remember him from doing Shaun of the Dead, Hot Fuzz, The World's End. So he's an English director that's really got a unique style and a great sense of humor. And Baby Driver is based on a heist driver, a young kid named Baby. That's his nickname. And he's got tinnitus when he had an accident as a kid. So he's got this constant ringing in his ears. So he's always listening to his earbuds and his iPod to drown out the sound. It just so happens he's one of the best heist drivers around. And it takes place in the city of Atlanta. And his crime boss is played by Kevin Spacey, who gives him all these jobs along with different crews like Jamie Foxx and John Hamm, and they really go on these incredible heists with great special effects. And it's the old kind of fashion special effects where it's not computer, it's all done practically. So you see some really amazing car chases that are staged, and it's got a hip soundtrack, it's got a great sense of humor, it's kind of dark in places, but it's been the darling of all the film festivals. It went in wide release this week, and it's just a fan favorite, and you're going to hear a lot about it. So Baby Driver is just an awesome, high-octane thrill ride.
All right, you were listening to Jeffrey K. Howard. You can find his full video reviews at VegasFilmCritic.com. That does it for today's International Edition, but you can find us anytime at voanews.com. Thank you so much for joining us, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Greg Burns. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting American ideals and institutions.
The United States declared independence from Great Britain in 1776 to secure for all Americans their unalienable rights. These rights include, but are not limited to, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Thomas Jefferson, chief author of the Declaration of Independence, by using the word unalienable, claim two things about our human rights. First, these rights are not given to us by the government. We have them even if the government does not respect them. Second, we cannot cede these rights to the government even by our own consent. They cannot be taken away from us, and we cannot give them away. Mr. Jefferson was careful to define our rights in this way because this definition justified a declaration of independence from Great Britain. Revolt, he argued, was lawful only if, after a long train of abuses and usurpations, a government continued to refuse to respect and secure the rights of its citizens. The Revolution was a last resort to Americans. They had to provide new guards for their future security because of a government that not only exercised despotic power, but also evinced a design to reduce them under absolute despotism. The 56 delegates who signed the Declaration of Independence did not take their duty lightly. They risked being charged with treason against the British government, but recognized it to be necessary. Benjamin Franklin, the eldest signer of the Declaration, said, "We must indeed all hang together, or most assuredly we will hang separately." They were willing to risk their lives to preserve their unalienable rights. Only united could they succeed. On this 4th of July, we Americans celebrate our independence and the heroism of the men and women who risked and gave their lives to secure our unalienable rights. We recognize that these rights are not unique to Americans. Indeed, they belong to every human being. Thus, on Independence Day, we celebrate not only our independence and our rights, but also the rights of all peoples throughout the world.
That was an editorial reflecting American ideals and institutions.